Good morning and welcome to the SISE Distinguished Lecture Series. We'll be starting in a few minutes. Morning and welcome to the SISE Distinguished Lecture Series. We'll be starting in a couple minutes. Good morning and welcome to the SISE Lecture Series. We'll start in 1 minute. Good morning and welcome to the SISE Distinguished Lecture Series. We'll get started now. My name is Jeremy Epstein. I lead the Secure and Trustworthy Cyberspace program at NSF. And it is my pleasure and honor to welcome Laurie Williams, our distinguished lecturer for today. Laurie is a distinguished university professor at North Carolina State, and co-director of the NCSU Secure Computing Institute and the NCSU Science of Security Lablet. She's worked with industry leaders, including ABB Corporation, Cisco, IBM, Merck, Microsoft, Nortel, and Red Hat. Laurie's research focuses on software security, agile software development practices and processes, particularly continuous deployment and software reliability, software testing and analysis. Among her many honors, Laurie is an IEEE fellow and an ACM Distinguished Scientist. Closer to our home at NSF, she's a career winner and is the lead PI for the SATC Frontier program, enabling a secure and trustworthy software supply chain. Her involvement in education research activities has included her role as lead investigator in NSF grants to improve the retention of women and minorities in computer science using various educational practices like agile software development and pair programming. Laurie received her PhD from the University of Utah, an MBA from Duke, and a BS from Lehigh. Besides raising three children, hiking, and running, she's a marathon runner, having completed four Disney marathons and the original Athens, Greece marathon, and numerous half marathons. Just hearing about that makes me tired. And with that, I'd like to thank Lori for joining us today and turn the floor over to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Jeremy. So to continue on, you know, my bio and making me a human and maybe making you feel more human yourself, just to let you know, life unfolds and gives you lots of surprises. And so, as Jeremy mentioned, I have three different degrees from three different places and three different things. I started out as an industrial engineer, thinking I'd be an industrial engineer forever. And then I went to Duke and got a business degree and thought that would be my last degree ever. And walked out that last exam thinking I'll never take another exam again. And lo and behold, I went back and got a PhD in computer science from University of Utah. From professionally, I've just worked in two places. I worked at IBM and NC State. When I was at IBM, I walked into work one day thinking I would work for IBM until the day I retired. And circumstances that day caused me to completely change that and to decide to take a buyout and go back and get my PhD in computer science to be a professor. And so it shows, you know, you never know what's going to happen one day when you wake up in the morning. Your whole life could change. And in this case, it was a beautiful change. I do have three children, as Jeremy said. Two of them live in San Francisco. On the left, my daughter is a flavor chemist, and my son on the left works for Apple as a software developer. And my son on the right got his PhD in cell biology, and he lives in Raleigh, thankfully, near where I do. The other thing that I think may be interesting is a passion project that I have. I call it the Vibrant Academic Vibrancy, just a belief that I have that academics, particularly new assistant professors trying to get tenure and PhD students, go through a lot of unique pressures. And so I teach at NC State a course called Academic Vibrancy, and you know, really focusing on the holistic academic as a person who needs sleep and good nutrition and exercise and meditation and community, and you know, just looking at yourself as a holistic person. And so I'm happy to talk to anyone about that. But now we can go into the technical aspect. So talking about supply chain security, any software, you know, here, phones, cars, power grid, the majority of the software in any product is third party, open source software. You know, a lot of studies say about 80% of all software comes from third party or open source software. Only 20% is what a company will write, and that is the innovation and the competitive advantage. In recent years, we've seen a lot of supply chain attacks. Sonatype says that there is about an average 740% increase in supply chain attacks over the last 3 years. So it's really a very popular attack vector of recent. And so what are these attack vectors that are being used with supply chain attack? One is one that's been around forever, as long as we've had open source and third-party software. That is really just where, you know, software developer makes a mistake, oops, put something in there, like Log4j is an example of that. That was just an unfortunate mistake that was put in the code. Attackers discovered it, or people discovered it, and then attackers jumped on it and exploited it, caused all kinds of havoc. And so that's been going on, you know, that type of attack has been going on forever. Some new attack vectors though, one is similar to the last one, but it's with malicious intent. So the prior one is an accident. This is saying intentionally, an attacker wants to put something malicious into a code base so that they can then exploit it. So these are codependencies as an attack vector and even codependencies as a weapon. So putting vulnerabilities into the open source system or ecosystem so that people will download it and they can attack it. An example of that is protestware. This happened last year when Russia and Ukraine started the conflict. There was Node IPC where someone wanted to, like, basically what they did was check an IP address. If you were from Russia, your files got deleted. So that's a case where, you know, software downloaded and used as an attack vector. And so this is newer. Another newer one is using the build infrastructure as an attack vector. So CodeCov and SolarWinds were examples of that, where the build infrastructure was the attack vector. And then the last one, because no talk would be complete without mentioning ChatGPT, OpenAI, large language models, generative AI, is what's the potential to use these as a new attack vector in the supply chain? So the last three being the growth that we've seen. Because of all that, back in May 2021, there was an executive order on improving the nation's cybersecurity that specifically in Section 4 called out the security of the software supply chain. So a lot of focus on the supply chain of recent. So people, like with all of the, you know, there's the executive order, people can't sell to the US government unless they comply with the executive order. But in general, like even executive order or not, like what do we do about all of these things that are going on with supply chain? So like in industry, a lot of confusion, questions about what should we do and what is everyone else doing? And so what I'll be talking about today is a study really focused on trying to answer those questions. The prime study I'll be talking about is a study that I did in conjunction with Synopsys, an empirical study. And it's based on, if people have heard of Synopsys's or started out with Cigital's Building Security and Maturity Model, BSIM. And BSIM was started by Gary McGraw, Sammy Magiras, John Stevens, 13 years ago, actually almost 14 years ago. And what BSIM was a study that said, you know, what should, quote unquote, organizations do to be more secure? How should they build software so that the software is more secure? And what they started at that point was then interviewing companies to ask, you know, what are you doing? And if you were a company that got interviewed, you would get a report that said, this is what you do, and this is what everyone else does. And you can look at the discrepancy between what you do and what everyone else does. And then also they contributed to the community a report, a BSIM report, an industry report. And in that case, as their sample size got bigger, they had even by domain, what are people doing for software security? And so the study that I've been working on is inspired by that. And it's looking at specifically what should we do to reduce software supply chain risk and what are people doing? And so with that in mind, over the last 9-10 months, I have conducted lots of interviews, 43 interviews with 7 different companies, asking what do they do in relation to reducing software supply chain risk. Now, I will say that these 7 companies are early adopter, progressive leader type of companies. And so I'm going to show you the results of what people are doing, but you know, keeping in mind that this is what the leaders are doing. So again, 43 interviews, I still have more to come. I was hoping this, by the time this lecture came around, I was 100% done, not 100% done. But I don't think that the results I'm going to show you will change appreciably. I think that they're pretty stable. That's, you know, in conjunction with Synopsys, another activity that I have is, you know, Jeremy mentioned this Frontier grant. Secure Software Supply Chain Center. And, you know, so this is a group of researchers, academic researchers focused on supply chain. And as part of that, we've conducted 6 supply chain summits. And supply chain summit is bringing together about 15 people at a time from different government and industry organizations to talk about the complexities of supply chain. And what I have on here are kind of, they are headlines of papers we've written that document the summits. And we're going to actually probably in the future, the strategy will be to disseminate this, the findings of the summits on archive, but we did write some papers early. And in these summits, we bring you know, 15 people together and talk about, you know, what challenges are people having, what approaches are they using. I say about 60 people. There are some people who have come to more than one. So about 60 different people, all kinds of industries. We have run two in Silicon Valley, two in the East Coast, two with government. And while these results from these summits are not in the numeric results that I'll show, in my mind, I'm looking for consistency or lack of consistency between what I'm hearing at the summits and what I'm hearing in the interviews, and I'll say I'm hearing similar things. So it substantiates what happened in the interviews. One sentiment, which I'll bring out because I'll bring it out again in a moment, is the sentiment is, so there's this executive order and companies that want to sell to the US government need to comply with things coming out of the executive order. And that executive order was in place for all six of these summits. But really the sentiment of the people in the summit has been that the executive order is forcing industry to adopt security practices that should have been adopted 20 years ago. We want to be more secure. We don't want to just comply. And so that's the spirit of the people who are at the summits, which is a beautiful thing to hear. I do want to give a disclaimer that with all of these signals, these seven companies and 60 people who came to these summits, I can't tell you who they are. The summits, it's Chatham House rules. So Chatham House rules says I can't reveal to you who was there. And then as far as the study with Synopsys, eventually there will be a paper published and you'll be able to get that paper. When the paper is actually written, then I'll get permission or not permission from the seven companies to reveal their identities or not. It's up to them. So I unfortunately can't share the names of the companies with you. So let's go back to the sentiment from the summits. You know, people want to use the executive order to be more secure, and I'll say to reduce software supply chain risk. And so this is my view. This slide is completely my view of the progression of things. First of all, prior to the executive order, most people who worked in software security within an organization just wanted to get attention. You know, there's still so much attention on getting functionality out as fast as we can, and not as much attention on producing secure products. That's just, you know, the way it's been. The executive order has moved up the software security and the priority list, and that's a beautiful thing. However, you know, there was a lot in the second bubble there, a lot of like, oh no, what do we do now? And so a lot of companies, you know, did a lot of hiring and, you know, a lot of consternation and stress about this executive order. When time went on, as I'm listening to all these companies, because the first thing that came out of the executive order was the need to produce a software bill of materials, the first thing was, like, all of a sudden the executive order became software bill of materials. That's really the only thing people were completely focused on. And then the end of last year, the beginning of this year, there was more concrete guidance given on the executive order and something called self-attestation. So self-attestation is companies having to document that they followed good security practices. And so that was specified in a general way in the beginning of the executive order, but now it's becoming more concrete. It's still not completely concrete, but it's much more concrete now. And so that's the fourth bubble there. And I'm saying SSDF. So SSDF is a NIST document, Secure Software Development Framework, that has been very much tied to the executive order, and it documents basically software security practices that should be done in order to produce a secure product. And the self-attestation is very tied to the SSDF, as I'll show you in a moment. And so I would say in a lot of ways now, the executive order equals the self-attestation, which is defined in the SSDF, The SSDF does say you need to produce a separate bill of materials, so the executive order has broadened from just the SSDF. Here's where my opinion comes in, that in order to reduce supply chain risk, we need to do more than just have good software practices. So software supply chain risk management is greater than just the SSDF, which is greater than the SBOM. Even though the SSDF is a lot for organizations trying to comply with it, but there's things that are important that are not in there. So again, people asking, okay, you know, we want to reduce supply chain risk. What should we do? What should we do for the executive order? What should we do in general to reduce supply chain risk? Fortunately, there have been a lot of documents, good documents, that have come out of the focus on supply chain. Two of them here, and I'll explain why these matter to the study that I'm working on in a moment. But here's the SSDF, which is NIST 800-216. That's an important document. Down below is NIST 800-161, which is on cybersecurity supply chain risk. That is hardware and software. It's holistic. It's not just software. SALSA, which is supply chain levels for software artifacts, is guidance that started out with Google, but has moved into the OpenSSF, which is part of supported by the Linux Foundation. Very focused on, I will say, the closing up the build infrastructure attack vector, the CodeCalv and SolarWinds type of attack vector. So some guidance out of there. Some others. OpenSSF again has supported a document that started out of Microsoft, Secure Software, Secure Supply Chain Consumption Framework. This is as if you're consuming software, not producing software. So it takes a particular perspective. Cloud Native has a nice document, Software Supply Chain Best Practices. BSIM, as I mentioned earlier, has lots of software security practices, some of them directly related to supply chain. And finally, OWASP, for several years now, has had their SCVS, Software Component Verification Standard. So there's other documents. These are especially ones that I had chosen because very much focused on supply chain and not the broader perspective of software development. And so as I work to structure this, what should people do? And what are they doing study that I mentioned earlier, I created what I've called the Proactive Software Supply Chain Risk Management Framework. And the vision of the framework is to be a holistic framework, meaning not just focused on software development, so a holistic framework that industry can use to proactively mitigate software supply chain risk through guided adoption of tasks. So individual things that people do. Tasks is a NIST word for individual things people can do. And supports assessment, scoring, and comparison against industry peers, standards, and guidelines. So that's the vision. Basically, as I'll show you, I took the union of all of those documents that I just showed you to look at, you know, what's in common and whatnot, and to try to come up with really the superset of what people, organizations should do to reduce supply chain risk. So these are all of the documents I just showed you. And I have many pages, and anyone who's interested in actually getting this document, I'm happy to share. I'm at the version 0.3 level of this. Actually, I'm at the 0.4 level, but I haven't published it yet. And so ultimately, when I took the union of all of those documents, I came up with 72 tasks, and I'll explain the relationship in a moment. And for each task, there's a name, there's an objective, like why in the world would you want to do that? What are you trying to accomplish by doing this task? A definition of what the task is, the questions, which are my interview questions, but also a question that anyone can ask within their own organization. And on the right, the references of where did that practice come from? Or that task come from. And I took it out and tried to make it bigger here. So on the left is the task name, on the right. So you can see, like, for organizational security requirements, the executive order called for that. The SSDF calls for it. BSIM calls for it. NIST 800-161 calls for it, and the Cloud Native Foundation calls for it. Self-attestation says this is a practice or a task that is being an organization would need to attest to. So this is, I say, mapping all the things to all the things. It's a many-to-many mapping. That took a long time to come up with. And I was working with someone from NISC, Karen Scarfone, who explained to me those, you know, different types of mappings. NISC has, you know, a document where they describe all the different types of mappings. And so what I did is called bidirectional equivalence, which means each one of those is the same. They just call it different things, but they should all be the same. There's other mappings like part whole and others, but this is bidirectional equivalence. In theory, all of those ask for the same thing. They just say it in different words. And I will say, anyone listening, I would love to have feedback. I did this mapping primarily myself, somewhat based off of mappings that came out of SSDF and whatnot. But a lot of it I did myself, and scientifically, it's always good to have more than one person. And you know, the Microsoft document S2C2F, Adrian Diglio, the author of that, checked my mapping, and I would love more of that checking too. So of the framework, I mentioned there's 72 tasks at the union of all of the things. Those are organized, the 72 tasks, into practices, which are groups of practices. So there's 15 practices, which are the blue level. So some example, perform compliance, there's 5 tasks. If you look under governance, perform compliance, there's 5 tasks that make up the perform compliance practice, or over under deployment, there's 6 tasks that make up the respond to vulnerabilities practice. The practices are then grouped into 4 groups, a governance group, a product group, an environment group, and a deployment group. So there's an organizational structure for these 72. And this is looking at a life cycle model of how does this all fit in? So particularly at these 15 practice levels, and the 4 groups are down along the bottom. There's a color code, like green are done by a role called business management, red, role architect and developer, blue by IT, just kind of laying out where would all these things be done. Some of them across the whole life cycle up at the top and the sides, but some of them relate to a particular time in the life cycle, all the way to the retirement of a product. So why in the world do I need to have all of these frameworks? Why couldn't I just use the SSDF? And this is a chart that kind of shows that all of them were needed. So there's 4 different groups. And on the left side are all the different frameworks that I mentioned before and how many tasks were in each of the frameworks. So 72 tasks total in the PSSCRM. But if you look at like the SSDF has 34 tasks and most of them are in the product, which makes sense. Product is developing a product. SSDF, the D is developer. So it makes sense that the majority of the practices are focused at the developer. What I have in red here are the prime driver. So the prime driver of the product tasks came from the SSDF. The NIST 800-161 was a very influential document as well. It brought in the governance, a lot of the governance practices. And if you look at the 20, so 20 governance practices, 20 of the 23 governance practices came from NIST 800-161. The 5 in parentheses says that when I did the union of all of the frameworks, 5 of those governance practices only appeared in the 800-161. Another very influential framework was the cloud native software supply chain best practices document. A lot of the environment came from them, 13, and 8 of them only appeared in the cloud native. So it was important to bring all of these different frameworks together to get a holistic view of what companies should do. So now I'll give you some information on the findings. So this is a spider chart, and I won't expect you to get much off the spider chart. It's kind of busy, and I'm going to go into the details in the next slides. I'm going to give you just, if you look at the top right, the ratings. So I interviewed people in the companies, and based upon what I heard for a particular task, I said 0 is they don't do it. 0.25 says they're starting to think about it. They're kind of getting started. 0.5 says, you know, they're in progress. 0.75 says, you know, they're almost there. And then 1.0 says they do it. And in some cases, they're exemplary. So when you look around the spider chart, I have the 15 practices that come from governance, product. If you go clockwise, product, environment, and disclosure, the name of the practice. In the parentheses are how many practices are in, how many tasks are in that practice? That's the first number. The second number is how many SSDF practices are in there? So if you look at compliance as an example up at the top, there's 5 tasks in that practice. 4 of them are specified in the SSDF. The reason I'm like really focused on SSDF is because since people equate kind of the SSDF and self-attestation with compliance, there's so much focus on that. And as I go through, you'll see that there's a lot of things that are not covered in that. So if you look down at the bottom, P3 is component and container choice. There's 5 tasks in there. Only 1 of them is specified in the SSDF. So that's around the outside. On the inside, what you can see is how are companies doing? How are these 7 companies doing? The more towards the inside would indicate that practice isn't very well adopted at this point. The further out, the better adopted. This spider chart goes to 0.9, not to 1.0. So even though it looks like some are getting all the way to the end, there's another level. But if you look in the general case, so the lighter pink is all practices, the darker pink is SSDF. So in general, people are adhering more to the SSDF tasks than all tasks. But I'll go through the individual detail now. So I'm going to go through each of the 15 practices and then the tasks that are in the practice. And so this is the governance practice, the governance group, the perform compliance practice. And then there's 5 specific individual tasks in there. And you'll get to know this format in a moment, but the identifier in the framework, there's an identifier, which is on the left, so G1.1. If there's a star near it, that means that's in the SSDF. If there's not a star in it, then it came from someplace else. And then under average, this is saying of the 7 organizations that I talked to, what's the average adoption of that specific task? And then practice average is the average of those 5, the adoption of those 5. And then finally, SSDF average would only take the tasks that were in the SSDF. That's how you can read that. So my reaction to some of this compliance is in general, on the organizational requirements, people view the organizational requirements as that they have a defined self-development life cycle. That's, you know, in the general case. People have been checking licenses for a long time now, predates really this supply chain stuff going on. So people are fairly advanced, 0.65, so fairly advanced with checking the licenses. Not complete, but you know, pretty advanced. But you can see low adoption of producing attestation. So attestation is proof, if you will, or you know, a declaration that you use these good security practices that you're supposed to use. So currently it's okay if an organization basically has a PDF signed by an executive that says, I promise we use these. That's one form of attestation, moving towards more machine readable automated attestation. But producing it is 0.13, pretty low. Delivering provenance, so provenance is part of the SSDF saying you're going to provide information to the people you're supplying your software with about your practices, about your environment and whatnot, information about where you were, when it was built and whatnot. So low acceptance of delivering provenance information and low acceptance of delivering software bill of materials. So people are starting to produce software bill of materials, which is the first line of what's required in the executive order. So over the last 18 months or 2 years, people are pretty advanced with using tools to produce the software bill of materials, but it's not really going beyond that as far as sharing, delivering, and whatnot. So that's the observation. Another still in the governance group developing security policies and, you know, decently high acceptance of delivering software policies, some developing security policies. So one thing is that people do talk about doing, you know, having a good code review policy. Yeah, two people have to approve every pull request, but, you know, two questions where they start to fall off, which is why it's important to do interviews and not surveys, is do they check for security? So they do code review, two-person code review. Does it have anything to do with security? Maybe not. And then this comes in later too, like, you know, do you enforce that they're actually done? And maybe that's not as much as either. The biggest problem in this group is asset inventory. So from a supply chain perspective, a lot of, you know, a lot of focus on, we need to know what we're using, what our build machines are, what our servers are, what, you know, develop machines, like have an inventory of everything. And 0.29 says barely emerging. And the reason is that as people are looking towards producing this asset inventory, now, like, you know, they're kind of overwhelmed. Like, we use containers a lot and they're spun up and spun down. A lot of ephemeral environments, a lot of cloud resources, a lot of change happening all the time. And so, you know, really a lot of confusion of how do we produce this asset inventory now? Could be a business opportunity for someone. Next, managing suppliers. So people, this is not open source software. This is vendored third-party software. And in the general case, these people, you know, that I've spoken with who develop contracts with vendors are good at imposing, I say all the things. So imposing on the vendors, you have to use the same software development lifecycle that we do. You need to give us a software bill of materials. You need to give us provenance. You need to give us attestation. So telling, you know, the vendors that they need to do it. They're pretty good at that. As far as anyone actually fulfilling any of that, that's a different story, but the new contracts are reflecting the new requirements. Less mature at, so separation of duties is one of the tasks. And that's really saying that more than one person should be looking at these contracts, more than one person should be reviewing the contractors and whatnot. And that's not happening as much. I have seen cases where there's a collaboration between the contract manager and software security, so you know, where that approval process is taking place, but in general, it's kind of low. Training is a pretty good practice. So I say it's first place. There's tied for first place. So there's another first place practice as well. So training is role-based training, contingency training, where contingency is like, there's a security emergency, what should we do? And gathering attack trends. There is some room for improvement, particularly on the contingency training and gathering attack trends and communicating those trends to the organization. Some improvement that could be done there. You'll see me reflect in some cases, this differentiation between prevention practices, detecting practices and responding. Preventing means preventing a security incident, detecting a security incident or vulnerability and responding to one. And so training is a prevention. If there's good training, we can prevent problems. And so good to shift left. I think this is the last governance practice, assessing and managing risk. And, you know, it's not too bad. Everyone knows they need to do all of these things. So it was great awareness of the need to, you know, figure out which systems are more critical and track risks and decisions. But I would say the lacking is a little bit of what's your repeatable objective process for doing risk management. That's when it can fall down. It's more like we know what our crown jewels are and we focus on them the most kind of risk management. So there could be some work done on making these repeatable and objective. Security metrics is hard. It's a hard problem. And so that's the lowest of these. And so how do we know, is any of this working? Are we getting more secure? That type of a thing. The whole industry would like to know better how to do that. All right, now moving into the product group. First one is developing security requirements. Only at about halfway here. So halfway means we're making progress. Similar between product security requirements and release integrity. So these are, you know, proactive kind of practices early, not organizational security requirements, but product specific requirements, like at the architectural level, choices like using a memory safe language, sandboxing, isolation, modularity, use of security features, like doing that upfront. And then, you know, providing customers assurance your software is legitimate, especially like code signing. So some work can be done there. Next is building security in, so proactive software security practices so that you're building a secure product, you know, pretty much getting there. The lowest one is secure by default. So giving a product to a customer where this it's as secure as possible without requiring the customer to make changes to settings in order so that the product is more secure. That's the lowest. It's a security versus usability type of classic issue. And some people are, you know, still having trouble with the trade-off the way, you know, everyone always has been. The last one is interesting, in-house components. And in-house components, so there's all this focus now on third-party components, open source components, and scanning them and updating them. And sometimes the in-house components can be forgotten. So it's really putting the focus back on the fact that people develop in-house components and need to make sure they're scanning them and looking for CVEs and making sure they're not abandoned and whatnot. So having in-house components be first-class citizen, getting the same treatment as third-party components. The next one I have here is in second to last place, so low. This is managing components and containers. And what I have on the bottom here is a, you know, kind of a flow chart that came from a document that came out of various government organizations. And so basically what this is saying is, if you're gonna bring a component or container in, you know, this flow chart here, you know, make a good choice, scan it. And then once you scan it and feel like it's a good choice, issues have been fixed, then put it in your own component repository and use it. And that's kind of in the P3X, you know, make a good choice, only choose from trusted repositories, require some commits from your components, then put them into your own vetted repository. And the last one is preventing component vetting bypass. So preventing a developer from using a component that hasn't gone through that process. And really kind of low adoption in all of these cases. And I have here components are better than containers. Containers, there's a lot of way, you know, not a lot of checking for containers that are coming into an organization from where they come from and whatnot. So this is a concern, and I'll bring that concern up again because it's probably the biggest attack vector in supply chain or through components and containers. And this set of practices here could use some more work. Next product grouping is discovering vulnerabilities. And so these are like finding vulnerabilities that are in there. In this prevent, detect, response, this is a detect grouping. I have here that it's in third highest place of the 15, so high is good. code review is lower than you might expect. You could hear things like, yeah, we require code review for every pull request, but not necessarily related to security and not sure how it's actually enforced that something actually happened. So we could definitely get better with that. Have lots of tools. So the automated scanning tools is 0.96. It's almost complete, almost a 1.0. But so having a lot of tools, yes. Using them, which is the third one, not as much. So sometimes not run all the time. Sometimes the vulnerabilities found are not fixed and whatnot. Executable security testing is pretty good. A lot of external penetration testing and bug bounty, less so internal. It would be good to get some of this internal so it's more shift left done earlier. Regular third-party compliance is sort of low. And it's because it seems that once a vendor is approved, they're approved, not as much tracking to make sure that they are following their contract and they are fixing their vulnerabilities. And then also once an open source product is brought in and it's allowed, not a lot of review to go back and say, is this still a good choice? So that the secure computing analysis tool, SCA tools, will say if there's a vulnerability, but not necessarily if no one's maintained that. Like, so 2 years after you put it into, you know, approved it, has anyone maintained it since then? Not a lot of look back. This is last place. So this is managing vulnerable components. There's two tasks here. One is consuming the SBOM. So having a software bill of materials and actually looking at it, no one does that. And then dependency update. So you run the secure component analysis tools. It tells you which components have a new version, which components have vulnerabilities. And this is drinking the water out of fire hose, which that's the picture, is indicating that these tools just give you an overwhelming amount of information. And as far as people having a really good process for how to manage that is 0.38. So kind of low. You know, it could be things like, well, Dependapop gives you a pull request every morning to tell you all the components you should update, but people don't do that. You know, like there's risks associated with just accepting everything. And so not a good systematic process for how to handle this across the board. Now moving into the environment grouping. So making a secure environment, this grouping, of environment, especially would focus on like the SolarWinds code cov build infrastructure, like an attacker getting in through the environment. And the first one is safeguarding artifact integrity. And you know, if you look across the board, advanced authentication is maturing. So things like multi-factor authentication, developers using SSH keys. So you know, people adopting those, you know, at least halfway anyway. The branch protection process could be better. So what that is saying is you can't advance in your branches unless you pass certain security tests, less security tests than there could be in that branch process, especially with mono repo. And then just a comment about the last one, decommission assets. And this was a practice, I say, I just added it to the model pretty recently, so I need to circle back with some of the companies. So sample size is pretty small at 0.25, and it is not referenced in any of the documents that I talked about. And as I was talking with people, especially Jay White at Microsoft, I'll say that, who was just someone who I spoke with. So it's not necessarily, Microsoft's not necessarily in any of the studies, it's just someone I spoke with. And he really emphasized that decommissioning assets, so a system is done, a machine is done. If you just let it sit without decommissioning, you might have passwords, down-level vulnerability, down-level components that no one ever updates. So like just letting something sit is dangerous. So you need to have a process for decommissioning the assets. And there's a lot of maturity that needs to happen there. And then safeguard build integrity, again, especially focused on the code cuffs kind and SolarWinds kind of thing. And there are 7 practices here. Halfway, 0.49 overall. So some areas of improvement. So release policy verification, these are automated release policies. Could be better, like it's treating these as code. These are like information, infrastructure as code scripts, GitHub Action kind of thing. Better handled as code, better templated, better standardized across an environment would be good. Verifying the dependencies on the environment on build could be better. people in general don't utilize compiler, interpreter, and whatnot to fail, and they allow them to give warnings. Reproducible builds not happening yet. Ephemeral builds pretty good. So ephemeral means spin up a build environment, build and let it go. That's pretty good. Salsa advocated initially anyway, hermetic and parameterless builds, hermetic saying don't go out to the internet in your build process. A lot of people don't do that. Parameterless. So, you know, people are getting better. I think that the focus on build environment has been a good thing. Secure software development environment. And this is, again, tied for first. In general, IT departments are doing a good job at keeping the development environment safe. And this is a prevention practice. And probably the biggest concern, maybe, there's role-based access control. But in a lot of cases, there's worldwide read access, potentially through the whole corporation. Not sure if that's the best, maybe not enough release privilege, but like pretty much everyone uses role-based access control 100%. But then within that, there's some concerns. And then the final group, deployment. So responding to and disclosing vulnerabilities. And this one came in second place. Overall, prevent, detect, respond. This is a response practice. This is a case where you have a problem, you know, you sort of have no choice but to respond to it. So typically response practices have higher adoption. One of the ones that has a lower adoption is emergency fix. That was a practice or a task that came out of the S2C2 framework. An emergency fix is basically focused on what if you have a component and the component supplier won't fix it? Do you have a process to fix it? What's your process to fix it? What's your process to contribute your fix? And, you know, there's some room for improvement there. Also, it could be more proactive eradication. Eradication would say there's a vulnerability type. Don't just fix the one you found, but fix that type throughout your code base. Not a lot of focus on that. One company had a good perspective, which basically says, you know, once a bug bounty, some bug bounty people find a particular vulnerability type, they'll just keep finding it for you. And so then they keep wanting to get paid. So kind of an acknowledgement, if once they find something like that, we better eradicate it, or they're just going to keep bugging us. And the last one is in the deployment as well, monitor intrusions and violations. And system monitoring, people are doing pretty well. Build process monitoring, not as much. So, you know, this is again the SolarWinds and CodePub. Is someone in your build environment and you need to detect that intrusion? Some more work needs to be done there. And that's the end of the practices. Let me just give you some high level view. These are the top 10 practices or tasks most adopted. And one thing to look at is of these, of the top 10, one governance practice on the top 10, one product task in the top 10, 5 environment, and 3 deployment. Deployment are the most reactionary, most response. So again, typical that people have their responses because they have no choice. Great that, you know, the environment that's proactive at preventing intrusions. I'm not as much focused on the governance and product. So some of the ones that are universally accepted, the build output, that is saying put your build output in a separate place from your build input, from authentication, monitoring changes to configuration settings, overall system monitoring, having automated security scanning tools, having role-based training, having a secure orchestration platform, having risk-based vulnerability remediation process, having separate environment and analyzing your vulnerabilities. So all of these really well accepted. The bottom 10, least accepted, 4 from the governance practice, 3 from the product practice or product group, 3 from that environment group, and none from the deployment group. So all of the deployment practices that are accepted. So things no one does, consume an SBOM, nobody does reproducible builds, barely does anyone deliver provenance information, barely does anyone produce attestation, barely does anyone require signed commits, barely does anyone deliver software bill of materials, barely does anyone prevent component, like people bypassing the component vetting process. So that barely preventing the bypass means developers can get components into the system without going through the official process. Not a lot of asset inventory, not a big use of the compile and build process to find vulnerabilities. And then last, not a lot of verification of dependencies in the environment in the build process. So these are the least adopted. Just a warning, this is how I feel, is that the biggest attack vector that gets a lot of attention these days is use of code dependencies as an attack vector and use of dependencies as a weapon. That's like, you know, a lot of people, when they think about software supply chain risk, they think about this, putting malicious commits in. But really the practices and the tasks that would mitigate this attack vector need to be adopted more than they currently are. So what's next? I do have to finalize the interviews. Like I said, I think that the findings I shared are stable, but I need to finish it and publish the paper. Other things that I would like to do is to map the tasks that I presented to you to specific attack vectors, specific, like not high level, but specific attack vectors to see, and actually to, I have a partner of one of the 43 people I interviewed who would like to work with me on this, is to take specific attacks that happened and then go through the steps to say, this is what the attackers did. Could these particular proactive tasks that I'm laying out have stopped it? So that would be an interesting exercise. And then I think it'd be good to track this over time, see are people adopting the practices. And that's it.
Well, thank you very much, Lori. That was a great talk. There's some questions in the chat, and I'll ask some of those of you in just a moment. Do you want to stop sharing? I'm going to, actually, first thing I'll do is, as a reminder, this lecture is being recorded, and it'll be posted, and there's the webpage where it'll be posted soon in the next few weeks, just as a reminder for folks. So I did some work in this area actually before BSIM. One of my papers, you cited actually one of my papers in this. So it's interesting to me to see how far it's evolved. And one of the things that, so thinking back 20, 25 years when Bill Gates wrote the famous security memo and woke up all of Microsoft, that we have to pay attention to this security stuff. And we've made a lot of progress in the past 20 or 25 years, not just at Microsoft, but everywhere. But how quickly do you see this moving so that your scores get to the point where a study like this is irrelevant because everyone's getting a perfect score in everything? Everyone's getting an 800 on their SATs. How do we get to that point? How long will it take to get to that point? And other than regulations, are the things that really are going to move us towards that 800 SAT score?
Right. Yeah. No, I would guess that, I mean, you know, I think that there could be an analogy between Bill Gates' memo and the executive order. Like, I think both very defining moments. But based upon the conversations I've had, I think there's a long way to go because, as I mentioned, these seven companies I talked to, they're the leaders. You know, they are and they have a long way to go. And so if you take the overall software industry, I think it'll be a while.
All right. So one of the things in the very limited study I had done 15 years ago, or maybe a little more than that, was trying to look at the difference between how big companies and small companies dealt with these things. Do you have a sense in that regard? And is it going to take longer for the small and medium companies to catch up? Or is the fact that they're more agile an advantage in this case?
I do think that they play off. So, I mean, in the summits, yeah, across the board, we had some small. And so what the people who seem to perform the best and even do reproducible builds are the smaller companies just starting out. And so smaller companies just starting out, and or people even within a company talking about their new products, they can do much better if they start from the beginning, whether it be small company, medium sized company, they seem to do better.
So there's some great questions. I'm going to read some of the questions from the chat. The first question, well, two questions from the same person that are interrelated. Could you elaborate on security metrics, what and how to measure evolution, current status, grand challenges, future direction, and how does a security metrics in a government group relate to security checks in the environment group?
Okay. Yeah, I need you to repeat some of them. So like, okay. There's like two levels. I mean, when I think about security metrics, I think about two levels. One is like, you know, from just say from Jeremy, you know, the frontier we have, you know, one of the things we are trying to do is say, are we as an industry doing better? Are we getting better at preventing supply chain attacks? And that's a really hard one because you have to define like, what is a supply chain attack anyway? And people change, you know, like different asset levels. There's a bunch of change. That's a really hard one. When I talk to the companies about security metrics, I mean, they're looking at specifically their escapes. They're looking at, you know, how many penetration testing vulnerabilities do they have? How many customer vulnerabilities they have? So they do actually have how many static analysis. So they can look at their tools and look at the output of their tools and say, like, it looks like we're secure enough. Like they have a little bit more of a handle on that, not the high level.
Okay. So let me, I'm not necessarily doing these questions in order. The PSSCRM looks like a wonderful framework for securing software supply chain. I was wondering if and how we can apply it in the development of open source software. Have you seen relevant cases in how open source projects apply these tasks among the four groups, governance, product, environment, and deployment, which ones may be more challenging for open source projects? And I wonder whether the stuff that, what are they called? The open source group that you mentioned at the very beginning, I wonder if they're working in that area.
Yeah, no, so I've had some, as I've gone through the studies, and I've presented like the general framework to OpenSSF and had the same question. And would I say the governance, probably almost none of those practices would be adopted. But really within the OpenSSF, when I presented to them, like they would love a study like this on open source organizations. And so I'm definitely open to doing that. And so if anyone has a contact there, and there was one open source organization that said we could do it with you. I wanted to get through the companies first because they were complicated enough. Open source, where you're trying to say like, who does this? Will you talk to me? It's harder, but I'm definitely open to it. My prediction would be very little adoption of governance, maybe more of the product, probably less so of the environment? Like, you know, I think that probably they would be the strongest in the product area and be lacking in the other groups. Mm-hmm. But open to that study if anyone wants to contact me about that.
Okay. You presented the results from 7 companies, but there were 43 interviews. Were the 43 interviews from those 7 companies?
Yeah.
Okay. And are you planning to increase the number of companies beyond 30?
With proper support. So, you know, I did this in conjunction with Synopsys so far. It's very time intensive. I'll tell you that. It's very time intensive. So it does require support, but it's very interesting. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Having done it myself 15 years ago, I certainly agree with you. Yeah. In all of the frameworks you mentioned in MAP, do you have a recommendation on which is the most effective to reference when implementing and validating technical controls for secure default configurations, either in pipelines or deployed software?
So specifically secure deploy settings, is that what it's called?
Yeah, pipelines and deployed software, yeah. A question, how can academia help reduce the software supply chain risk? Well, the obvious answer is join your research community at NCSU, but this is someone who's already a doctoral student. Maybe they'll be interested in joining your team as a faculty member when they graduate. There are other teams besides yours working on this at other universities. Can you tell us anything about your competitors, so to speak?
Yeah, competitors, collaborators, synergistic. I mean, we try to view it as that way. So one is there is a SCORED workshop. The SCORED workshop last year was at CCS, which was in LA, it's in Amsterdam, Copenhagen. And they have a deadline in 8 days. If you need to submit something quickly to get there, I would do that. It's a great place. Like the last year when I went, I was really surprised that there was 40 people worldwide at this workshop. So if you're interested in supply chain, I would totally try to get to the SCORED workshop. That's one thing. Within the US, the frontier, like, and this is a contact me kind of thing. We have quarterly meetings and we invite people to our quarterly meetings. So if you're doing research in this area, we want to meet you and we want you to come. So like we do that every quarter. We rotate the locations of our the PIs in the group. So definitely contact me about that. Even worldwide, we have people from other countries call in and present and participate in our quarterly meetings as well. So try not to have competitors, try only to have collaborators.
So there's been a lot of talk in some parts of the US government that we need to focus on memory safety. And that's just a small part of your big picture here. Do you have a sense of how and why they're focusing in that area and how to get a bigger vision than just memory safety?
Yeah, so I mean, like memory safety of the things that I talked about would come into like product security requirements. So looking at things like memory safety, safe languages, isolation, sandboxing, things like that. So there are other strategies, not just that from an architectural level should be considered. So I would broaden it, but be thinking about ways to prevent the impact of supply chain attacks.
Mm-hmm. So it's important, but it's not the be all and end all.
Right.
Yeah. Can you share insights on the low scores for some of the SBOM related tasks? Seems a little bit surprising since SBOM has received a lot of attention and discussions when the executive order came out. And of course, Alan, why am I blank?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Alan Friedman
has achieved fame and notoriety as Mr. S-bomb. But people don't seem to be paying much attention to it, according to your results.
Yeah, so what the results show, and you know, so it's my numeric results, the summits, and then I do go to the MITRE has a quarterly supply chain meeting, SSCA, I don't know what it all stands for, but anyway, which is a great meeting to go to as well. So like from that overall picture, I'll say that people are getting better and better and tools are getting better and better producing an SBOM. And that was the first line of defense of what the executive order asked for. So that's what people are responding to, producing an SBOM. The next step, which is storing an SBOM and sharing an SBOM, there's just a lot of technical complexities. Like how do people share an SBOM between organizations, doing it securely, sharing it only with certain people because there could be proprietary information in there. You only want to share it with certain people. The government, like, should every agency contact Microsoft or the same SBOM, or is there a way to share it? These are things that are not worked out yet. And then the next phase is actually using the SBOM, using it for good. And there's not really tools available yet. So like there's an opportunity there. And I know that vendors know that actually using an SBOM for good. So, I mean, the low scores, I'll say the low scores are twofold. One is all of that. The technical aspects of moving beyond producing it is one. To sharing it and using it is one. But then the other is, I'll say that I've heard more than one time from vocal people, what attack vector does the SBOM mitigate? Like, and so not really feeling the urgency, like we want to stop the attacks. And so if you think about prevent, detect, respond, SBOM is a response one. It's not a prevent one. And so if people are focused on preventing attacks, they're not as motivated. And not everyone does have to produce an SBOM. Not everyone sells to the US government.
Mm-hmm. 20 odd years ago, an executive at Johnson & Johnson told me that they weren't worried about attacks because who would attack a baby powder company? Of course, they have significantly changed their view over the intervening decades. That was an early and fairly naive perspective, and I'm sure that I know they've changed their view. But are there some organizations that are just so small and insignificant enough from an attacker's perspective that they don't need to worry about it? I mean, there are companies that make software for pizza parlors or things like that. Are there some that can just say, yeah, this is a bunch of stuff, don't worry about it? Or does every company that's creating software really need to focus on it?
I do think every software company needs to focus on it, because like once something is in the supply chain, anyone could be attacked, whether it's pizza parlor or whatever. Just kind of, we saw that back with the Mirai attack, whenever it was, like every home monitor that had a default password got attacked, and then the internet got attacked because of it. So I don't think anyone's immune to it. However, for sure, there's a lack of awareness. Mm-hmm. So if you could say to a typical, like I have talked to like small vendors and explain, like, you know, that you can't just take a popular component off the internet and assume it's good. Mm-hmm. They believe it is. Like, oh, all the software that's in an open source ecosystem is secure. Like, no, not true. And they really do believe that. So there is a lack of awareness. And also it's kind of a little bit of a flip-flop. Like it used to be, if a lot of people, if the download rate was high, a lot of people use it, therefore it must be secure because everyone else uses it. But actually now it's kind of like, if a lot of people download it, it's really prime to be a target of a supply chain attack, because the attack can be leveraged to high degrees. So a lot to watch for.
Right. There's a value to security through obscurity, in a sense, that if you're using something that everybody else is not using, even though it may have all these problems, attackers are less likely to have spent the energy to figure out how to attack you through it, and unless they're specifically aiming at you. If they're aiming at you, you're in trouble. But the goal is, as the old joke goes, to run faster. You don't have to run faster than the bear. You have to run faster than your friend.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
There's another question here. In these frameworks and guides, there seems to be a lot of focus on individual components, almost like completing a checklist. The people with whom you have met, however, have expressed an earnest desire to be better than meeting the minimum requirements the checklist compliance would achieve. How can these people and their organizations model the interactions at a system rather than component level, including human factors, to help identify and mitigate risks to system failure, which can occur even when every component is individually compliant?
Right. So there are some of the individual tasks, like, so threat modeling is a good example of one. So if you're threat modeling, you are looking more holistically, not at individual. So there are aspects that are system-wide, system architecture, system design checks that are in there. But there was another question besides that. What was, like, so it is more holistic. It is more holistic. Oh, the human aspects. Mm-hmm. So you are absolutely right. And I've thought about that, the human aspects and how to get that in. So like in the frontier that Jeremy supports, we have a whole focus on human aspects, because if you think about the adoption of any of these 72, every single one of them requires a human to adopt it. And the humans care about they do still care about producing functionality and not being interrupted with their workflow and whatnot. And so I would say, like, if you take all these 72 and put a circle around them, that would be the human aspect, not an individual task.
Mm-hmm. So going back to the issue of smaller organizations, are government agencies like, say, the Small Business Administration, are they a vehicle to get some of the word out that you're using here? I don't worry about Microsoft and IBM and Google. They certainly have all these issues, but they also have the resources to address them. But how do we help with the small companies? Is it SBA? Is it the chambers of commerce? What is it that can help them to even know that there is a problem?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think all of the above that you said, to get the word out and, you know, thinking about, you know, where to publish these types of things so that they're read by the right people. But yeah, the word definitely needs to get out.
Mm-hmm. Another question from the chat. Some of the build provenance discussions that you talked about, are there publicly available sources that academics can use and to study build provenance or lack thereof?
Well, I mean, for people interested in build provenance, I would certainly look at two things. One is the SALSA framework, SALSA, SLSA, supply chain levels for software architecture, and the Intoto framework, which is cryptographic expression of provenance. So those are the two things I would look at. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that the academics obviously always worry about is, where do I publish the results? So are there places that folks should be looking? IEEE SecDev is one, and you and I work together on the IEEE Security and Privacy magazine. Are there other places that folks should be looking to understand the latest research?
I mean, I think supply chain research is, you know, it can, like, I also publish in software engineering places. So like XC or I haven't published in FSC yet, but, you know, I think that it would be fine. But then I think all of the classics, so Will Enck, who's my partner in crime at NC State, He's the program chair for Oakland / S&P next year. He put supply chain specifically in the call. So I think all of the classic security venues would be a place to look.
How about the coming at it from the business side? Are there places where people publish the business side of supply chain, things that computer scientists might never have heard of?
I can't say that I know the answer to that.
Okay. I bet there are, because I know there are people in business schools looking at these issues from a completely different angle. Okay. Cool. Okay. So if this were, if we were in person, let's see if this is going to work. If we were in person, I would be giving you this challenge coin. Let's see if I can turn it so you can see it. You know, I'm going to take it out of the little. Can I do this without ripping it? Yeah. So we created these challenge coins in a. That may be, yeah. There we go. It's got Grace Hopper, Lady Ada Lovelace, and Alan Turing on one side and the NSF logo on the other. This is the size challenge coin. If we were in person, I would be handing it to you. Since we're not in person, I will be mailing it to you. But this is a symbol of NSF and size's appreciation of your participation in our distinguished lecture series today.
Well, thank you. It's an honor.
Yeah. So we have a break now until for NSF folks are welcome to join at 3 o'clock this afternoon, where we'll have more of an informal discussion where I won't be asking all the questions, but it'll be more of an informal discussion. If there are questions from participants who are not NSF folks, I'm sure Lori would be happy to respond to email or something like that. Any closing thoughts, Lori, before we let people get some lunch or whatever meal is appropriate for your time of day?
the only closing that I'll have is that send me an email. I'm happy to share the framework. As I mentioned before, from a research standpoint, there's only collaborators, no competitors. So I'm interested in hearing what you're interested in so that we can all work together.
Great. Well, thank you again, Lori. Look forward to seeing you at 3 o'clock. Hope to see many of the NSF folks at 3 o'clock. And to everybody, NSF or not NSF, thanks for participating in today's distinguished lecture.
All right. Well, thank you. All right. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Bye.